Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Dan Glickberg from Fairway Market with another helpful Thanksgiving tip. When selecting your turkey, the vacuum-sealed package should be wrapped tightly around the bird. If it's not, look for another turkey. You can find more of our tips at fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today is kind of like in Karate Kid when Daniel first meets Mr. Miyagi. We have.
Yikes.
I've been waiting for that drop. Michael, or Mike.
Mike is better, please.
Call him Mecca. I'm Michael. This is Mike, master of all things food in New York, radio, television, wonderful guidebook. If you don't know him, where the hell have you been for the past 10, 20, 30 years? I mean, how long have you been in New York in the food scene?
We're getting to be 30 years. 1982, January.
So, yeah. And that was cooking. That wasn't...
Yeah, no, that was straight out of the CIA. I was a kid from Philly, didn't know much. Didn't know anything about New York, honestly. I just had kind of a, like a lot of shift, like a troubled youth.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of drugs, a lot of partying. And I knew if I went back to Philadelphia, I knew what I was just going to fall back into that stuff again. I just like too many friends, too many phone numbers, too easy to get back in. So it was like come to the city. This was then. Plus, this was even then. You know, this was the restaurant town in America.
I mean, what was there for regional cuisine in Philly other than cheesesteaks?
Nothing. There was Le Bec Fin. There was one French restaurant George Perrier had called Le Bec Fin, and it was stuffy old. I mean, it wasn't so dissimilar to what Andre Saltner might have been doing, or maybe Jacques Rochou. It was classical French food. One or two other chefs, and then like cheesesteaks and red tablecloth Italian stuff.
Yeah.
There was nothing. I mean, Philly was an old Quaker town that kind of 7-8 o'clock at night, the town was quiet.
Yeah.
Even to this day, it's still a quiet town.
Yeah, but I mean, you had people like Alfred Portale. Didn't he go to Le Bec Fin and then come to New York?
Was he at Le Bec Fin?
I know, not sure. He was in Philly somewhere.
I think
Straight
that was
Bass, maybe. Or...
Yeah, but I think that was once he was famous.
I
think that somebody hired him to sort of bring some New York juice to Philly.
Exactly.
Like, we got this guy, and he's got 3 stars, and he's a big shot.
But it's always an exodus to New York. It's not like people go to Philly and say, oh, I'm going to start my culinary career here.
No, man. No, man. So New York was the thing. You came here because this was really where you could cut your teeth. It's where the great restaurants were. I had a little sublet apartment down on Greenwich Street in one of those Mitchell-Lama buildings, 310 Greenwich. And I remember I had student loans. My rent was $500 a month, and... I was on the waiting list at the Four Seasons restaurant, which is, you know, classic, great old New York, you know, Joe Baum comes out of that that lineage. And the chef was a guy named Seppi Rankley, a really brilliant Swiss guy. And I got on the waiting list and took a job downtown at the Vista Hotel, told him I'd leave the minute Seppi called me. I'd give him 2 weeks' notice, and he did. And that's where I started, you know, working at the Four Seasons. And it was great. I mean, I had a great, great run. But I remember, I mean, it's funny you remember things. I remember starting there, working 6 days a week, having to figure out how to do my budget, and my first check was $187 take home. And my rent's $500, and I'm like, this sucks.
Yeah.
This doesn't work. I mean, 187 times four, less expenses, plus student loans.
Just work more, so you don't have expenses.
Yeah, I worked a lot, and then I got lucky. My girlfriend then was doing her internship from the CIA at the Maurice, which was a wonderful restaurant at the Meridian Hotel. Christian Delouvrier was the chef. And they had like a crisis. One day, two of the best guys, one a Tournon and a sous chef, got caught stealing a galantine out the back door. They were going to have a party, and they wanted to bring some food home. So they were, you know, it was a hotel. You can't steal from a hotel. I mean, there's security checks as you leave. So they were walking out with a tureen wrapped up in a towel, and they needed somebody bad. So I made a deal with Christian hired me to work. Long story, but I was working nights at the Four Seasons, and then they let me come in the morning early to work lunch, set up the kitchen, turn on the Bain Maries, open up the walk-in box, basically an excuse to come in an hour early and leave an hour. Come in an hour early and leave an hour early. And then I did lunch at the Four Seasons and dinner at the Maurice for 7 months. which was insane.
Yeah.
That's like literally two full-on services, 6 days a week, 18 hours a day.
But at that age, you could kind of burn yourself out like that.
Yeah, completely right. When I look at that, I mean, I had more energy then than I have now, you know, times 20. It was just crazy. It was just like full on, this is what you have to do. You have to make the kind of money. And then finally, I got a sous chef job at Maurice, which was a big salary bump up.
Yeah.
And I could quit the Four Seasons after a year. But yeah, it's been a while.
So you mentioned Christian Delouvrier, which a lot of people in this town of my generation don't 100% know. I think the last place he was at was Alain Ducasse.
Which was sad. Yeah. Sad. Before that, he was at L'Espinasse, which is... L'Espinasse had Grey Kuntz, which got 4 stars, and Grey had a very modern, typical... It was Grey Kuntz's food.
Yeah.
When he was great. And Christian replaced him and just totally redid the menu. Christian's from the south of France. He's from Gascony.
Yeah.
He's really into layers of flavors and braises and big flavors and... we worked with Sondrens, but he really... Sondrens was an intellectual, and Christian's more of an organic guy, and... Christian got 4 stars at the Maurice. At L'Espinasse. Christian had a great run there, and I have no idea why he took that job with Ducasse, because it was like, if the restaurant gets 4 stars, oh, Alain Ducasse says, well, I'm Alain Ducasse, of course.
Yeah.
If the restaurant doesn't get good four stars, it's like, you're out the door. I'm Alain Ducasse. You screwed up. I mean, it was like you know, lose-lose. There's no way you're going to get any credit in that guy's organization, and that's what happened. They got 3 stars, and he was kind of banished, and... It's funny. I haven't seen Christian in a long time. He's at a place up on the Upper East Side called La Mangeoire. I'm going to be there tonight, so I'll tell you next time I see you how it was. But
yeah.
I bumped in last night. I was at Fedora, and the table next to me was Riyadh from Mineta,
yeah.
And we got to talking. It was like a funny night. It was like chef's night. So Riyadh comes in, and we're talking, and Riyadh mentions he loves what Christian's doing up at Mangeoire. And then the guy, the next table over, was the new chef at Frankie's 570. And then on my way out the door, somebody buys me. I'm with a friend of mine, and somebody buys us a couple of drinks as we're putting our coats on, getting ready to leave. And I'm like, who? And it was the girls from Stellina.
Yeah.
It was Sarah and Emma. I'm like, what is this? Like, the chefs hang out over here? What's going on?
That's cool, though. But, I mean, this wasn't overnight. This was of your decades in service, in the trenches, as a cook, as food media. I don't want people to get the wrong impression that you can just all of a sudden burst on the scene and then get drinks bought for you at some chef's night out at some restaurant on the Upper East Side.
Yeah, no.
You know,
you've
built yourself such a great networking community because of honesty and humility. So,
well, thank you. No, it's really this business. I think the guy, I'll give such great credit to Tony Bourdain, because I think when he wrote Kitchen Confidential, it was the first time somebody really wrote about what the industry's like without these rose-colored glasses.
Yeah.
This wasn't some, Harvard graduate chick from Cambridge saying, this wasn't MFK Fisher. This was a guy saying it sucks and it's full of losers and most of us are on drugs and we work 6 days a week and we screw girls in the walk. And, that's kind of what it was. Those were those days. I mean, there was no glamour to this business. And I don't think he had any idea what he would have become, because it was like, I would tell people, I cooked when I was in junior high and high school. I started when I was 13, which was way long ago. And if I'd said to my high school guidance counselor, on career day, Mike, what do you want to be? I don't think chef existed as a word.
Yeah.
It was like, I want to be a cook, because the guys that I were working for were like ex-Marines. That's where people learned to cook.
Yeah.
These were guys that wore white t-shirts, smoked cigarettes on the line. Cutting boards were wooden then, and all the cutting boards had just these burn marks around them because they put their cigarettes down while they cut meat or did whatever they were doing, and then they'd pick the cigarette. That was what kitchens were. There was no aspiration that you could take a culinary career and blow it up into anything.
So though there was a different meter for what a chef was, I mean, there were chefs. You mentioned Alain Sendrens, who is a patriarch of many New York kitchens. Where did you work with him?
Worked with him. He was the consulting chef at the Maurice, because Maurice was run by Jack Parker, was a real estate guy. Meridian Hotel owned the other half, and Meridian was part of Air France. So Meridian's genius vision back in the 80s was they would have these hotels all around the world, and they would have a consulting chef. There was a three, so it was Paul Bocuse, Alain Sendrens, Trois Gros, whatever the chef was. Every 3 months, he would come to the restaurant. He would do a new menu with the chefs. You'd close. You'd do a press opening of the new menu. And your cooks can go work for this guy. So it was almost this hotel idea that restaurants didn't really have to make money. But if the food was great, people would come to the restaurant and stay in the hotel just for the food.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it ever worked out that way. But Sondrens worked he was our consultant chef. And luckily, he really liked me. And I got to work with him in New York and in Paris at Arquestrat. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, it was a different... The world was just much smaller back then. It was just... New York was a much different scene. most every New York chef of my generation went to Europe to train because there was no paradigm. I mean, once you worked for Andre Saltner, once you worked for Jack Rochus, once you worked for Fezzeguet, you kind of had to go to France to really see what was going on, because the difference between New York in the 80s and France was day and night.
Yeah.
They were just doing such better food than we were, mostly because of ingredients and somewhat because of technique, and then that just changed. American kids came up and got really good.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of surprised the French guys that, you know, they thought we were just, you know, grew up on cheeseburgers and curly fries, and we would never get it. And, you know, you look at, I mean, a guy like Jack Rochus, you look at all the guys that came out of that kitchen. I mean, you know, a whole generation from Charlie Palmer and Frankie Crispo, a whole generation of American cooks, New York big-name cooks, they're now in their 50s, worked with Jack Rochus. And then as they came up, you know, you began to be able to, and the ingredients got better here, you really began to see this paradigm shift. And I think now there's so much talent in this country, and the ingredients here is good or better than Europe, which is an amazing thing to see.
Yeah.
Because it just wasn't that way.
Well, I mean, it's probably partially through subsidization, but at the same time, everything was imported.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because it was here. It just wasn't looked. It was cheaper, actually, to get it.
Yeah, and we didn't have it. It was still, I mean, in the 80s, we would get, if you had a good French restaurant or a good whatever restaurant, you were getting deliveries from the Rangis Market twice a week from JFK.
Yeah.
And they came on like Tuesdays and Fridays, and it was Catch as Catch Can. Because there wasn't this networking. I mean, you have to give, I'll give, you know, credit to guys like Boulay and some of these guys who early on said, let me find farmers local. Let me find farmers in Connecticut, upstate New York, Jersey. They can grow stuff for me.
Yeah.
And then you had this whole organic thing going where there was suddenly a distribution channel between farmers and restaurants that in America, it was trucks.
Yeah.
You know, it was Driscoll strawberries from California. It was out of season asparagus 12 months out of the year from wherever.
Well, at a point, you worked as a food importer.
Yeah.
And I'd like to actually talk about Rungis in Paris, because I got lucky enough to stop by there with Pascal Barbeau from Les Trance. He's one of few chefs that actually go out to, and it is an airport. It's right next to Orly now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's airplane hangars. And there's one, Viands, all just whole beef. And one just all greens. One just all wild foraged mushrooms. And it's just absurd, but it's all in one place. So you didn't have to go through that networking, visit small farms, gain relationships.
Yeah. It made it, for the Parisian chefs, it became, you went at night. So if you went, you probably went at 3 in the morning because it was closed by 6 or 6:30.
I don't know. I screwed up my days, and I actually was out drinking that night, and I went, oh, shit. I have to go meet Pascal Barbeau. They're like, who's that? I'm like, oh, he's like a 3-4-star chef. I'm not sure, but I'm drunk right now, and I got to go meet this guy.
Yeah, well, it would have been because, I mean, you went to Rangis Market at 6 o'clock was closed.
Yeah.
So you went overnight.
It was like 3 a.m., I think.
Yeah, that's when it was. That one was full on. And they had a fish market, a produce market, a meat market, and as you said, foraged mushrooms. But France also had this tradition, like Italy. I mean, France also had these great 3-star restaurants in the middle of nowhere. You know, you had Marc Menot at L'Espérance in Vézelay. You had Trois Gros out in the middle of in Rouen, which is an industrial city. George Blanc was in Vona. But those guys would have farmers coming to their back doors. I mean, you'd literally have the guy knock on the door with like twigs in his hair, holding a big box of just picked chanterelles or morels. So the French and the Italians sort of understood this whole, I mean, locavore for them is like, duh, like, what, there was no option B.
Yeah.
That's how we live. In America, you know, we were into distribution. America is a different, you know, it was a different food culture. So the ingredients now, honestly, some of these ingredients didn't exist in this country. And some of them are just a result of great networking now where they've created this tie between farmers and kitchens that didn't exist a generation ago.
Well, you worked at Tavern on the Green, Windows on the World, I mean, legendary restaurants.
Yeah.
Were they localvores?
No, you couldn't be. A tavern was, I mean, I was kind of proud when we were at Tavern. Tavern had been, Warner Leroy was this impresario, you know, no one remembers who he was these days, but Maxwell, Drew worked for Warner. So Drew, in fact, the bar at Tribeca Grills, the old bar from Maxwell's Plum,
oh, yeah.
Drew bought it at auction. You know, Warner was this guy. He was larger than life. His father did The Wizard of Oz. He came out of Hollywood in that tradition. And he'd always had Europeans, Germans, and Swiss that were French running his kitchen. And in 1984-85, he hired an American kid who was a chef de cuisine at Lutèce, because Warner at Lutèce said, Andre, I want to do better food at Tavern. What can I do? And Andre said, hire one of my guys. So it's a guy named Stefan Kopp, who's still a friend of mine, was hired at the age of, you know, 31 to be the chef at Tavern. And the first thing Stefan did was hire all Americans underneath him. So he had a night chef, a day chef, an executive sous chef, with Frankie Crispo, was Greg Godin, was a bunch of guys that are still out there now. And I was one of them. And we were this American team, and Werner also rebuilt the kitchen for us. So he spent like $1 million on what we wanted to make that kitchen work. You know, new tile floors, new stock pots, a whole new brigade. We weren't doing anything ahead of time. Everything was done to order. It was a challenge.
Yeah.
But it was still, at the end of the day, what you find when you work volume is it's a killer.
Yeah.
There's like, it suddenly becomes lowest common denominator food. There's a really, I mean, Tavern on a busy night did 1,700-1,800 covers. On weekends, you did 1,000 brunch. In an hour, you turned the kitchen, and then you did 1,700 covers on Saturday night. We on the holidays, it'd be like 4,000. It was, and there's a point when you just can't make great food at those kind of numbers. There's like a diminished returns with volume.
Yeah. No, it's funny reading a lot of New York Times reviews and other restaurant pieces on boutique restaurant or 40-seaters. And, you know, when execution isn't there, and then hearing of guys having worked in restaurants where it's thousands upon thousands of covers.
Well, thousands is hard. I mean, I'd say the balance, I mean, if you look at like per se on a busy night, like if you look at the great restaurants in New York today, what's per se going to do on a busy night? 100, 105? I mean, Bernadette's not going to do too much more, and that's a really well-oiled machine, right? It's been 4 stars forever with just 2 chefs. I mean, Danielle's probably the guy that does the most volume that looks like bespoke food because he's just got a great kitchen, a great brigade. It's a physically beautiful kitchen, but yeah, volume's tough. I mean, look, I mean, Dave Chang's, everybody loves David, and I'm not, I mean, I told David this. I mean, I've had more mediocre meals at Sambar than I can count. I've had great meals, and I've had meals a week later that were just, what's that? But Momofuku's great. Why? It's got 20 seats.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of easier to control, and that's how it used to be in the French, you know, 3-star Michelins, was it was, they was one, they would turn the table once a night if they did that. So if you had 60 seats or 50 seats, you did 40 or 50 covers.
Well, that was so awesome about going to Rungis with Pascal Barbeau, is we get back to the restaurant, he unloads everything, and he's like, okay, see you later. And I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll see you. I'm like, so how long does it take to get a reservation here? He's like, 3-4 months.
Yeah.
Because it was 24 seats and 1.5 turn.
Yeah.
That's it. I think they do like 40 covers a night.
Yeah, that's how, I mean, and even then, the paradigm for those French chefs who were really doing the best cooking on the planet at that time for that kind of food, they were still having trouble making money. I mean, Joël Robuchon, who was maybe the best chef of his generation, retired at 50, closed Jamin, 4 stars, just said, I'm done. Or 3 stars, excuse me, Michelin. You know, the highest honor you can get, he'd had 3 stars forever, just said, this is so hard to make money. You don't know? And I understand why, having been in those kitchens. Sandrin's closed Luca Carton, 17 years at 3 stars, and just said, it's like walking a tightrope every year. It's too hard. It's not profitable. It's too much stress. I'd rather have fun and have a great 2-star restaurant and sleep at night and you know, not have to worry about my food cost being 50%. And that's still a struggle. I mean, that's still something chefs struggle with all the time is, you know, it is a business at the end of the day. You know, it's, you wonder why restaurants go out of business, why some of them fail, some of them don't, why you eat some of the stuff you do. It's, you got to make money. And that's sort of the weird, that's where chefs have to put their businessman hat on. I mean, it just, a good friend of mine, Josh Eden, Shorty's 32, closed a couple of weeks ago. And I was like,
yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah,
yeah, I was like, yeah, it's a shame. The place was busy. I don't know what had happened. But and he was a great guy. But somewhere, you know, between the lease or something, it just wasn't a hat.
Well, being chef and manager isn't always the same hat.
It's totally different halves of the brain.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, chefs are their worst enemies that way.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and maybe talk about when French technique became American food and how you made your shift out of the kitchen, but not away from the restaurant into food media. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Mike Colomeco, guru of the food scene prior to this show even existing. I wanted to also just give a little plug about your radio show, which has been going on since, what, 2006?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, 2006, now it exists only in podcast form in this market. We're 100-some affiliates around the country, but WOR decided just, which isn't unusual in New York, that most AM stations just sell their broadcasting on the weekends. So come Friday night, midnight till Monday, the morning drive, it's Dr. So-and-so, and it's the lawn man, and it's whatever it is. It's whoever wants to pay for it. But yeah, it's on. It's a podcast called Weekend Food Talk now, and it's a 2-hour show, live call in, but it's mostly just me talking.
Yeah,
because I'm not in this live market. I just figure it's going to be a pretty long monologue, and let's have fun with it. It was a fun show to do live when I did it, but it also became kind of OR was just a funny place to be.
Yeah,
politically, it became a strange station.
Well, I mean, it was also a really cool path of people that you followed, Arthur Schwartz, and then I didn't know you mentioned both Rocco Dispirito and then Tyler Florence, and then you.
Yeah, it was Arthur. Really, was a guy that made the brand. He had that show for 9 or 10 years. You know, and he was the food critic for the Daily News and a, you know, smart Jewish guy from Brooklyn that got the New York food scene and, you know, really connected with WR's audience specifically. And then when he crashed and burned, they picked up Rocco. And, you know, that was one of Rocco's many steps along the way. And then Tyler, which was curious because, I mean, Tyler's a cool guy, but he doesn't know New York at all. So, yeah, I was the choice after that. So it was a couple of years. It was like 3 years worth of 6 days a week.
Yeah.
But it's nice not to have to do that because my real baby's a PBS show, and that's on every week all year long, 6 o'clock, Channel 13. And that's a great, you know, I get to chronicle the New York food scene, which is, you know, people say, where do you get ideas for the show? And I'm like, dude, this is New York.
Yeah.
I mean, ideas? I mean, if I could do this show twice a week if I wanted.
You know, they could probably blindfold you, drop you off in a place, and you find the story.
Well, almost. I mean, I can't tell you that. Somebody else made that claim once. But there's so many. I mean, the scene here is just, New York's always been characterized by its velocity of change and the amount of talent that comes to its shores and the way neighborhoods transformed. I mean, we talked earlier about, off microphone, about, you know, downtown and Drew Nieperant in the early days at Montrachet. I mean, I lived down on Greenwich Street in the 80s, and there was nothing in Tribeca. There was, you know, Teddy's, and then Odeon opened, and that was like, you know, like a hipster hangout spot. I mean, Patrick Clark was a great chef, but it wasn't that thing. And then Montrachet came, and then think what Danny Meyer did to Union Square and what's happening now in Brooklyn. It's crazy. I mean,
if you haven't been out to Roberta's, I mean, this was Mike's first time here. And,
yeah. It's amazing. I mean, I just... Brooklyn's on fire. There's just so much talent that's just percolated where, you know, Manhattan can only absorb so much. And the fringe neighborhoods of Manhattan now have become Brooklyn. You know, it's just a matter of finding a good lease. I remember when Smith Street first got going, talking to Alan Harding, who opened up his first restaurant. It was really the beginning of the Smith Street Renaissance. And he said, I was looking downtown in Manhattan, and I was looking at the rents, and I was like, man, you got to sell a lot of chicken to pay that. And then I found this spot on Smith Street, and granted, there was nothing there, but it was $1,000 a month for a commercial space. And he's like, if it fails, I'll have like a dope apartment with a really sick kitchen in the back.
I'm saying, you can't even get rent like that.
Right, you know, I'll have a floor-through, ground-floor apartment on Smith Street with a commercial kitchen, whatever, you know. So it's sort of out of necessity that these chefs find places. And New York's just got an audience. You know, we are as a tribe of, you know, New Yorkers, just, you know, we're all about food. Because creativity can't exist without the commerce to support it. So at the end of the day, you can have all the creative talent you want, but unless you have people buying, it's good for nothing. And New York, it's just the intersection of creativity and commerce. Yeah. It always has been. There's always, people will spend money here for good art and or good food or good craft, whatever you want to call it.
Well, when did you take your creative side of the brain and get out of the kitchen and focus on food media to better explore and promote
that? There was a little bridge. I had my wife and I had two kids while we had a restaurant in Cape May for 8 years, and we ran it in the summer, came back to New York in the winter. And when my kids were little, I was just, okay, this is a game changer. I mean, that I think most people find that having kids changes something. And I knew, suddenly it occurred to me, all the chefs I'd worked for, from Seppi and Christian, that had families, how horrible it was for them, because they were never around. They missed everything. They missed the soccer games, the graduations, the school plays, the weekend. They just, you work this life that is everyone else's off time.
Yeah.
You work nights, you work weekends, you work holidays. So I thought, I got to do something else. We sold the restaurant. We had a few bucks. I started a food import business because I knew food, and that was a good little bridge where we were in China when no one knew it was in China, and nobody knew China had apples, and it turns out they've got a third of the world's apples. You know, like, China just keeps surprising people. And But that wasn't, my heart wasn't in that, because that was like, making money doing that felt like stealing, because it was just, I used to work, you know, coming into a restaurant and peeling carrots every day and making stocks and mopping the floor felt like an honest living. You know, making six figures slinging pineapples from Guangxi province was like, I don't know, I felt like I was selling crack. What's this? Like, where's the craft in that? So I was in North Jersey, and I had a neighbor whose daughters were my son's age when they were all little kids, and my kids, I had a home office in the import business, and they were always at my house. My kids would come off the bus with his kids, and they would always come to my house and play, so he'd come over for dinner a lot. And he was a photographer, shooter for NJN, and Kirk Soar said, Mike, we should do a food show. It was like 1998 and 99, and nobody was doing anything I liked then. You know, it was all the same stuff. It was like, hey, my name's Mike, let's make lasagna. Yeah. You know, who wants to do that?
Oh, what was that pastor that was on PBS? Right? Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm like, was I really watching this weird food show back when I was younger?
Really? A pastor?
Yeah.
I don't remember that one, but Kirk wanted to do a show, and I said, okay, I'm an ex-chef, and I have access to kitchens. Let's do a show nobody's doing. A real documentary style, on location, in the field show. Camera goes up on your shoulder, news cam style. We put lavs on people, we get a stick mic, and we spend a day in kitchens. And we shot a demo, we went to the Food Network, and it was 99, and they weren't doing anything like that. Yeah. I mean, to me, they're still like a great waste of bandwidth for what they do. I mean, most of the TV Food Network stuff's just flat out garbage. But you know, this wasn't for them. Everything they were doing then was in studio. It was Emeril. It was all that other stuff. They were doing nothing documentary style. And the next place I went was Channel 13, and they really liked the idea. We delivered three pilots, and they went crazy. They went viral. I mean, the first 3 weeks they aired, the second and third week had the best Nielsens, because it was right in the fall sweeps. They put us up in October, November. Then they re-aired them again in February. We had the best Nielsens of those 3 weeks then, and then they called me up and said, can you do a series? And that was 10 years ago. So
yeah.
It was just, you know, honestly, it was luck beat brains. It was just like nobody, there was no plan for this. There was no, I went to the Wharton School and decided I would do this food thing. It was just like, hey, that's all I know.
Yeah. I mean, when you made that crossover too, were there specific kitchens like, oh, I'm going to go and spend time in that kitchen and show
people?
Yeah,
I did.
What was your first episode?
I'll tell you. Yeah. No, it's funny because I really wanted to, I mean, I think that the strength of New York is not just that we have the great, great restaurants, but we have this great diversity, too. And you can eat anything from anywhere 45 minutes from Grand Central. I mean, you know, in terms of ethnic, in terms of price. So the first three shows were three New York delis. We did Second Avenue, Katz's, and Carnegie. We did a show on Harlem where I went up to Charles Southern, who was on 8th Avenue up in the 140s. We did a restaurant, what's the cat's name? He's out of business now. Copeland. He was a great story. Mr. Copeland had a restaurant on the west side of Harlem for 30 or 40 years. And we did a story on Wells Famous Chicken. Now, all three of these restaurants are closed. But I was so happy to have done it because Wells Famous is where Chicken and Waffles was actually invented. It wasn't the place in L.A. It was Wells Famous in New York City. And we got the story from Mrs. Wells, who told us about how his husband came up and blah, blah, blah. And the third one was just a funny mishmash because we didn't have any money. So Ryland Inn was in New Jersey. There's a great diner called the Summit Diner. So we did like a dinner at the Ryland Inn, breakfast at the Summer Diner, and a Korean place in Midtown called Gamiok that's still there. You know, Salongtang.
Yeah.
So it was sort of we didn't know what to do. I mean, we didn't have any money. We had shot this B-roll, and we had these three shows. And I said, we'll just call it like the day in the life of a Jersey commuter.
Yeah.
Like, you wake up and you have breakfast at the Summit Diner. You have lunch at Salongtang, and then you have dinner, and we'll cover it with voiceovers. I mean, it was whatever. It was necessity. But yeah, so it was all over the place. But the idea was to tell stories.
Yeah.
And then the next season when we were actually, I kind of cobbled together a budget to work with. I mean, we did Danielle. We went out and we did the French Laundry. You know, we began to do more serious takes on food as well as all sorts of ethnic stuff.
Yeah, but it's that stuff that feels real. Kind of a, you know, your wife is what, South Korean?
Korean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Going to 32nd Street. It's still a maze.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one block is a whole world.
Yeah.
If you've not been to K-Town, what is it, between Broadway and 5th?
Between Broadway and 5th, there's a great little vegetarian place called Hangawi that's on the other side, on the other side of 5th, on 32nd. But for the most part, it's that corridor. And it's authentic Korean food for Koreans. I mean, they're not doing, I mean, a lot of what masqueraded as Chinese food or Thai food in Manhattan was often underseasoned, over-sweetened, you know, neutered,
well,
not
it was
so hot.
Not provincial. I mean, you didn't see Sichuan Thai, I mean, Taiwanese. Like, that didn't happen
Didn't happen until a few years ago. And the Koreans, from day one, were just cooking for Koreans. I mean, I remember going into good Korean restaurants on 32nd Street, and they wouldn't seat you. They'd give you a menu, and you'd read the menu, and they'd say, okay, do you think you want to eat here? Because they were really tired of white people coming in, sitting down, getting a glass of water, messing up the table, and then asking, you know, in some specific restaurant, asking if they did, you know, short ribs. No, we don't have short ribs. You know, this is Salong Town. Yeah. This is what we do. We do pajun. We do Salong Town. We do the raw oysters with the thing. And no, we're not going to make you a noodle stir fry. And so as defense, they just say, here's the menu. If you don't like it, don't even bother us.
Yeah.
Because we got more business we can shake a stick at. So. Yeah, because the Korean scene still in Midtown is great, and the Korean scene in Flushing is great too, and North Jersey.
Yeah.
I mean, Fort Lee's got it crazy because that's where the Korean expat community lives.
Yeah,
I mean, after L.A., New York has the biggest Korean community in the country.
What other big ethnic communities other than like Chinatown are still inherent in New York?
Well, I mean, you know what? We were out in Queens last year, and in Corona, there's this big Mexican community now. I mean, I asked a guy from Nixtamal, why are you in, why Corona? You know, when you think of Corona, you think, you know, back a generation, and because that's, for some reason, that's Mexicans were late arriving to New York, that's where they settled. There's a big Filipino community out there. Of course, I think many, like, you know, you talk to foodies all the time, probably the best Chinese food in the city now is out in Flushing, and some of those food malls and those food courts and some of those restaurants. So it's pretty remarkable. I mean, we pretty much have everything. We don't have anything Danish yet, though, do we, right? You were talking about that off microphone before.
Danish?
Because what Marcus did at Aquavit wasn't really Swedish food either. It was sort of Swedish food through Marcus's prism.
That's
so
true. I mean, Scandinavian being such a hot cuisine at the moment.
Yeah,
I don't know if there are more traditional. I mean, Van Dog down in the East Village is Dutch-inspired. But I don't know if there's any, you know, hard-hitting Dutch restaurants.
No, there right isn't. That's always been funny because I think there's Senegalese. I mean, there's African communities up in Harlem. And I mean, we have kind of, you know, Peruvian. You could sort of find anything from anywhere. But it's funny. The Northern European tribes just don't get served. And who knows why? Maybe they're just, they eat at home. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Who knows what the answer to that one is.
There are plenty of Danishes in New York, but...
Or something.
Yeah, or whatever.
Whatever passes for
bastardization of that pastry is.
Overproofed and undercooked with a lot of sugar in it.
But, you know, throughout the years eating in New York, are there still go-tos? Are there still stalwarts of, you know, an older era that have not changed their quality and concept that you go back to?
Yeah, you know, there are, and it's, I think, in, like, different genres. I mean, Keen's has gotten a lot of love lately because people finally discovered it, but I've always, you know, I've always liked Ben Benson. I thought Ben Benson was this cool guy, man. He goes back to the early days of Alan Stillman's Empire when they were running places called Thursdays and Fridays, which became TGI Fridays.
Yeah.
But they had a club called, they had a bar, restaurant called Fridays, and it opens Thursdays and Wednesdays, and Ben Benson's is like a classic American chop house, and a young guy doing that same kind of thing was Michael LaMonaco and Porterhouse. It's kind of like new generation of Ben Benson's, where you could be a foodie and love it. You could bring your uncle from Ohio that just eats meat and potatoes, and they'll love it. I've always loved that place, and there's still, you know, a couple of places in Chinatown. I mean, I still think the Peking Duck House has great Peking Duck. Hop Key across the street's a dump, but I still love, you know, the black bean sauce with the little snails. I mean, there's still these places you go to, and I don't, I mean, one of the great mysteries to me is why the deli scene kind of dried up in New York. You know, 2 million plus Jews living in New York City, and what are we left with? Katz's and Carnegie and this sort of Second Avenue.
Yeah, I mean, there's a slight rise in Ashkenazi, but you can't really dress it up. Sephardic has a lot more flavor and spice, but, you know, talking about stews and old European, almost like cooking, Scholand things.
I think of that dish. I love that dish, and that when Second Avenue closed, the original Second Avenue, that was all that stuff on the menu was just gone.
Yeah.
You know, all those really rich, gnarly, you know, barley and knuckles and pieces of meat. Dishes you just eat and you wouldn't have to eat for 3 days again.
Well, everything that took a while to cook.
Yeah, all the braises.
So I feel like, you know, they flipped everything. Oh, this takes, you know, 20 minutes to make. There wasn't that same kind of heart and soul and, you know, long time and care.
That was grandmother. That was Eastern European grandmom cooking. I mean, so, and that's why I'm so glad to see, like, Russ and Daughters, they own the buildings. So they're not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
So, or Barney Greengrass, you know, these vestiges of what had been this old Jewish tradition where they were all over. Even when I came to New York, there were so many delis and so many more of those restaurants around. But I don't want to watch nostalgic about the old New York, because I think what's great is the new thing. The changes. I mean, we're sitting out here at Roberta's, and we just wrote that review a couple of months ago that I don't think the chef could have penned a better review for himself. I mean, it really describes sort of what this place is. It's a one-star restaurant if you want to come here and just do nothing but eat pizza. It's a three-star restaurant if you sign up for the tasting menu. It's a solid two-star and everything in between. And, you know, where are we? Bushwick? What is this neighborhood, man? It's Williamsburg Borders?
Yeah, Williamsburg, Bushwick. It's out there. It's its own place. It's autonomous. It's Roberta's world now.
Yeah, it seems to be Planet Roberta. And you know, I mean, Williamsburg's kind of got its thing going on, and there's great pizza. I mean, all of this stuff. Look, when I started in this city, you couldn't get good bread. You couldn't get it. The bread got to the bakers worked at night. They delivered it in these big brown bags at 6 in the morning.
So they just steam and...
By dinner, it was stale. Yeah. So the idea now that we've got, you know, Balthazar and Sullivan Street and Tomcat, I mean, it's crazy. And butter to put on, that's real butter. I mean, you guys have a future. I say you guys because you're 31. I mean, the future for young foodies in this country is just remarkable, because the paradigm's so swung to the point where I can tell you that all my old French chefs, like Denia, like Delouvrier, like whomever, they'll admit now that the best ingredients are in America, better than in France, and the technique here is as good. So it's full on. It's our time now.
Yeah. We could leave it at that. I think that's the Goonies, right? It's our time now.
Is though? I didn't know. Really? Oh no, man. No,
that's a great quote.
I think the cooking, I think the most vibrant culinary scene in the world right now is a scene taking place in America. From Portland to Austin, Texas, from, you know, St. Louis to small cities, little restaurants popping up, and of course the big ones like New York, Chicago, San Francisco. It's just, we are the place to be.
So when are you going to do a national version of your book?
The book, forget books, man. Print's like so dead. It's so hard to get money out of these publishers. I've done a lot of shows in Europe, and what I'd like to do is more shows in America. I mean, I'd love to go to Portland and spend 4 or 5 days filming, and go to Seattle and spend 4 or 5 days filming, and go through Texas. I'd love to go to, I mean, Birmingham, Alabama. There's Charleston. There's all of these great food scenes, and what's happening is they're just rediscovering, you know, the guy at Anson Mills and the chefs in Charleston, the guys, they're rediscovering, like, artisanal southern ingredients, going back to seed crops, whether it was, these things have been lost, and bringing them back again.
Importing
be right. Who needs it? And who needs Monsanto? Let's just grow grits the way they were supposed to be grown, from the kind of corn. And where'd they find that corn? Moonshiners.
Yeah.
Because they weren't using Monsanto stuff. I mean, it's just, this country's just got a food scene now that you kids are lucky.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky to have had you kind of blaze that path.
I'm not going yet.
Yeah. No, I mean, but have you there actually that, you know, help guide us. Man. And, you know, you really did blaze a trail for people like me and other people in food media that came out of the kitchen slightly apprehensive to arrive in this world, which can be jaded and slanted.
Slanted and often rewards mediocrity over merit. Yeah. But that's, I mean, keep up the great work, and thanks for the compliment. Much appreciated.
No problem. We'll have you back on.
Take the L train. Now I know my stop.
Exactly. Excellent. Mike Colomeco, thanks for being on The Food Scene. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, and hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
We'll do it, man. Thanks. See you later, guys.
The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Jones Family Farms is a 400-acre working farm offering quality agricultural products all year round, from fresh summer berries to Christmas trees in the winter, and an award-winning winery that is open from April to December. The reach of the Jones Family Farms is hard to capture, from their advocacy work through the Working Lands Alliance to ongoing classes in the Harvest Kitchen. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines,